I remember speaking with a friend and a mentor 4 or 5 years back. And this is around the time when I had left my previous career, a long career, and I was exploring. And I asked him, you know, how should I think about the next 5 years? And he gave me such a beautiful way to think about it. He said, look, if you're planning to work for another 5 years, then there's one answer. If you're planning to work for another 20 years, then there is a different answer, right? And I thought that was really clarifying, because if you want to remain in some professional capacity, if you want to remain productive, then you have to reinvent yourself. You can't sustain what brought you here and take that set of learning and knowledge and expect to see the next 20 years through it. It just became very obvious. Whereas if it were just, you know, if I wanted to work for the next 5 years and then retire forever, then I could, you know, drag my whatever life had taught me. I could use that and pick up a few more jobs. But that's not what I wanted.
Welcome to another episode of Midlife, Living in Full Expression. This one's in English, and today I'm joined by someone who has navigated leadership across continents, cultures, and decades of transformation, Rajdeep Indal. Rajdeep spent more than 17 years at Sapient, that's where we met, and where he led thousands of people through change as managing director in India. He later became chief transformation officer at Material, and today he's stepping into a new chapter as the founder of Moonjar Technologies. His journey spans the worlds of business, technology, and human leadership. And now, like so many of us in midlife, he's asking a deeper question. What does it mean to reinvent myself? Not because I have to, but because I want to. In our conversation, we talk about what it really takes to unmask old identities, to lead with humanity and responsibility across global contexts, and to redefine success beyond titles and achievements. We explore what happens when achievement gives way to meaning, and why midlife isn't a slowdown but a moment of powerful reinvention. Rajdeep brings a rare perspective as a man navigating midlife in India, balancing purpose and pragmatism, and reimagining what leadership can look like in a rapidly changing world. If you've ever wondered how to stay true to yourself while carrying great responsibility, how to renew your purpose after decades of performance, or how to find fulfillment beyond the next title, this one's for you. So settle in and join me and Rajdeep for a rich, honest, and deeply human conversation on leadership, midlife, and the art of reinvention. Rajdeep, we made it after numerous times of timings that didn't go right on my side, on your side once. I'm really happy that you're here. So welcome, Rajdeep.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm so delighted to be here. Just to be speaking to you after 25 years. I didn't tell you this, and I saved it for knowing that we were going to speak. I was such a huge fan of yours at work when we met 25 years back, and we didn't have a lot of interaction, but I always used to just look at you and admire you for your integrity and, you know, being plain spoken, but also bringing empathy. And I never had a chance to tell you. So when I knew you and I were going to speak, I said, I must tell Julia this because, she, you know, I've met hundreds of people over the course of our overlapping careers and the same place, Sapient. But you definitely made a mark. You left a mark on me. So
Thank you, Rajdeep. Thank you for saying that. And I appreciate it. I appreciate the words. And maybe for our listeners to just give a little bit more context, you already said the workplace that we met, which was Sapient. And I think we both had a wonderful way of learning how organizations can be. At least that's my remembrance of my time at Sapient. Because it was just a very driven, but also a very purpose-driven organization with values that we live by, regardless of whether, where you are now in India, in Delhi, and here myself, when I was with Sapient, first of all in Germany and then New York and London, we always carried the same values, and that means a lot. I'm very gracious that I was able to experience that.
Yeah, much has been written about Sapient and its values, and you know, all of us personally benefited in a way. The thing I learned was it became kind of a self-selecting filter, right? You come into the company, you look at the culture, the values, the behaviors, and you realize they either resonate with you or they don't. And if they don't, then you're not going to enjoy working in that place for a very long time. So you move out over a period of time. So I think having the values such front and center and really in a way in your face, like, you know, we weren't trying to put them on a poster on the wall. They were lived day to day. And I think they did that. They allowed for a set of people to agree on a set of behaviors that they were going to live by. But I also think, and I spent 17 years in the company and we went through multiple very large transformations, is that the thing that strategically that did for the company was it gave us a lot more resilience to navigate change and big change. Because very often in organizations that are confronting, you know, like large change that require them to reimagine themselves from the inside out, people get very, very anxious, right? They're going to lose who they are. But at Sapient, what we did was never who we were, right? That was distinct. Who we are was distinct from what we did. So because we were so confident about who we were in terms of our values and our purpose, we could change what we did without feeling as tied to it or as emotional about it or as anxious about it. And that's one of the things I only learned after I left the company and I worked in a few other places where I saw the muscles for navigating change and embracing change. Like they didn't exist, particularly because there was no shared definition of what it meant to be me or us, right? And that was, in hindsight, I don't know if the architects of Sapient's values meant it to be this way, Jerry and Stuart, who we talked about a little couple of minutes back. But I think this was an unintended but massive consequence that served the company very well.
I would agree. And definitely a role modeling, something that many organizations now are recognizing when they shift in these shifts that we're going through, but also in their cultural transformation, how important it is to bring these elements into the forefront. But maybe we'll get into that a little bit later. I'm intrigued to learn more about yourself. You so kindly spoke about me, how we met, and I can only reciprocate back that I always looked to you in awe because of not only the responsibilities that you were carrying at the time at Sapient, but also even if I forward to today and what I read about you, whether it's on LinkedIn or you know how I experienced you, you're always such a deep, I would say, individual. That's how I experience and read you. And I ask this question each time when I have a guest on this podcast, and I'm going to ask you the same. And that is, when you wake up in the morning and let's say you're not getting into any kind of roles, you're really just getting up. Who are you then? How would you describe yourself?
Well, that's a really tough question to answer, and I'll tell you why. Somewhere along the course of my life and my career, I realized that I don't relate to definitions very well. I find definitions to be very limiting, whether in terms of your corporate identity, the role you perform, or in your personal identity. You know, I think a role, the moment we define ourselves, we end up kind of getting attached to the definition because it gives us meaning. And I think it hinders our ability to explore other facets of ourselves that that are not obvious, that require a little more prodding, a little more exploration. So, you know, if you had asked me this question maybe 20, 25 years back, I would have said I'm a technologist at heart. But today I don't know what that means. Over the course of the last 20, 25 years, I realized I'm equally interested in design, in communication, and culture, and creativity, you know, and exploring all of those in writing. And exploring all of those gave me as much fulfillment and joy as, you know, I'm solving problems through technology. And I have learned to embrace all of them as a part of who I am. That's professionally, but also personally, I have, you know, and partly through just life's experiences and partly through reflection, I have come to like the idea of looking at life as discovery. You know, there are things that are waiting to unfold and you just have to, you know, develop your senses and perceive them as they unfold. And so, again, I feel like just, you know, embracing a definition often comes in the way of your ability to see what's unfolding in front of you. So who am I? I would say I'm just a curious person, just, you know, embracing life as an adventure and trying to explore different aspects of my personality and whatever talents God has given me or is encouraging me to you know, find out and figure out. So I'm kind of on that journey.
Yeah, beautiful. It sort of brings the question up in my mind of when that moment, if there was just one moment, I'm not sure if that can be answered in that way, but when that moment began, at least in you, to recognize maybe there's more to me than simply the technologist that you would have described yourself as maybe 25 years ago. How did that begin?
Yeah. You know, the many years back, maybe 20 years back, around the time that you and I last met in our workplace, I'd hired an executive coach. And and the company hired an executive coach to support me in my development journey. And he went and spoke to a lot of people that I worked with. And he came back with a consolidated list of feedback. And I looked at them and one didn't make any sense to me. And it said, Rajdeep presents to himself. So I asked him, what does that mean? I don't understand it. And he went and spoke to the person who said that. And he came back and told me, it seems like you present information the way you like to receive it. You are a top-down analytical thinker. So you present information in an analytical way. And if the other person that's listening to you doesn't respond to reason in the same way that you do, they will find you very uninspiring, boring, mechanical, right? And it sounds really funny when I narrate this today, but I didn't see that before, okay? I didn't see that there were people that could take in information, that could look at the world very differently from the way I did. And so what started as a, you know, as a journey to improve my presentation skills, recognizing the diversity in the audience, that's, you know, some people are moved by passion and some people are moved by reason. Some people respond to words and some people respond to images. And so it started with really basic things like that, but it developed in me a natural curiosity to understand the other and understand how you know, they took in information, how they processed the world. And as I stayed with that, it just opened my eyes to just the beautiful diversity that exists all around us, and that's shaped by the unique life experiences that every one of us have had. And so through it all, this idea that there is just one way of seeing things, the one way of defining what is right, I started to reject those that notion, and I started to be more in a kind of explorer mode. When I get into a situation, recognizing that there are as many versions of the truth as there are people, and I found that to be extremely rich. In that entire pursuit to be extremely rich, I wasn't seeking efficiency. I wasn't trying to mold somebody in my way of thinking. I was just trying to understand. And that particular feedback, and I still don't know who gave that, and I'm forever grateful to that unknown person for changing my worldview and my life, because it was such a gift. I trace a lot of my expansion and perspective to that moment of receiving a very specific feedback about my communication style.
Mm. Yeah, it sort of brings two things into my mind, which is one, obviously the power of feedback, which we both very well know of as we went through that school at Sapient, which I'm also very thankful for. But it also brings up in my mind, you spoke, you know, at the beginning around definitions and not wanting to define yourself through certain things or maybe labels, is what I would call it now. But defining yourself only in one way. So this feedback that you received obviously allows you to contemplate, to reflect, to stay curious of how to provide information to others so that it can be received in different ways. But also, it sort of occurred to me, yeah, it makes sense, because it demonstrates that maybe we've just locked ourselves into one way of being, and therefore we provide in that way instead of recognizing there's so much more in ourselves. We could be providing in this and that way. Why, you know, why stick with only the one direction?
Yeah. And I think, you know, partly the education system that all of us, you know, albeit in different parts of the world, but largely modeled on the same principles that we have been a part of, that, you know, values specialization over kind of integrating diverse perspective. If you look at organizations, they force specialization through narrow roles, metrics, you know, by having teams based on specialization. There's this constant reinforcement of a narrow perspective, you know, and that's what organizations value, because it optimizes for efficiency. You know, I learn the same thing over and over again. I do the same thing. But I think it dulls our worldview. It dulls how we see the world, because we carry the same narrow view of our expertise, of our role into the world, and we try to fit the world into that perspective that we have, the only perspective we have learned to carry. So part of the rejection of definition was also a rejection of kind of narrowness in perspective, and, you know, giving up the title and the role, and you know, I train to be a computer science engineer, but if I looked at all problems through that lens, I am very, very sure I wouldn't see the entirety of the problem, right? That kind of, you know, that shaped this entire idea of rejecting narrow perspective. And I don't mean narrow in a parochial sense, just in a, you know, narrow in a defined sense, that it gets defined by a specialization, a role. I think it's also led me to believe that the most interesting work, you know, happens at the overlap of specialization, overlap of disciplines. And that also, in a very, very fundamental way, reinforced to me the value of diversity. I mean, it's become a catchphrase in organizations, right? Diversity. But unless you experience it from your own, like at a very personal level, how a different perspective, a different set of, a different worldview, a different cultural experience, a different life experience enriches your own through synthesis. I don't think you fully recognize why diversity is important beyond knowing intuitively and you know, learning from your company and from whatever literature you may read that, you know, you must pursue diversity. But once you feel it at your core, then it's impossible to, you know, give up that idea. It becomes like a part of who you are. The experience that I'm talking about that got started with this moment of feedback, but also allowed me to look at all the devices that we had constructed within organizations that were reinforcing, you know, like a single perspective, a single way of looking at the world, and that were getting resolved through whether it was conflict or managed conflict, you know, split the difference. And I thought there was a far better way of seeing the world through curiosity, through seeking out diversity and having the ability to synthesize diverse perspectives, which again requires you to, you know, recognize your own fallibility in approaching situations. Going back to your question, I know I'm rambling a little bit, yeah. But to your question of, you know, who am I? It's I have now come to a place where I refuse to be stuck in any silo, and I like to move across disciplines, across specializations. I don't know enough about any. But there is so much excitement in just exploring and learning and see what connects in your brain and then speaking to somebody else and picking up those connections. And I find the most exciting problems live at those intersections. The most exciting solutions live at those intersections.
Hmm. How can I imagine that? So I know that your career path has taken you to really lead large organizations globally, and no doubt that a role like this needs an individual who can see various aspects, perspectives, cultures in order to integrate, in order to drive the organization forward. But how can I imagine how you take on that kind of responsibility and provide yourself in how you're explaining, providing yourself to, you know, drive the intersection of these different perspectives?
Yeah, the I think when we speak of leadership journeys, there is too much emphasis on role and not enough on responsibility. And I think literally, it is a responsibility. And if you can get yourself to seeing what you do as a responsibility towards somebody or something, it frees you up from being performative in what you're doing. You know, you don't feel the pressure or you can reject that pressure because you see that in the service of a larger goal. And that goes back to the pursuit of purpose and, you know, an alignment of kind of your personal mission with the place that you're working in. But to your point around global leadership, yeah, I've been very privileged to work with a lot of people across the globe. And it was not easy. I'll tell you the one thing that I struggled with, and I still haven't resolved it to this day. So without getting into a lot of details about my company structure and stuff, my role required me to straddle both my geography, the India, as well, you know, where we had a large, you know, we had about 8,000, 9,000 people, and the globe where we had a lot of my teams. And my constant struggle was to not come across as representing India in a global conversation. So I would overcompensate in trying to maintain a global perspective and trying to be seen as being global. And I don't know that I ever resolved that elegantly or in a way that provided me with satisfaction. I know I had a little bit of a bias of wanting to be global, and you know, I probably leaned into that aspect a little more. And in the process, I think quite often, my representation of my own geography was a little suboptimal. That in hindsight, as I look back on those years and that experience, I wish I had done it differently. But I think that is a common kind of conflict that we often face as we, you know, evolve from one cultural context, from a regional context, and take on a larger role where in a need to be accepted, we have to be seen as objective. We have to be seen as not representing the interest of any particular segment or region or what have you. That was a struggle. But the other bits, another challenge which I think I somewhat surmounted over the course of my journey was just understanding and being receptive to different cultural nuances and styles. And I was helped, going back to my point about, you know, rejecting definition, I was helped kind of by a belief that I've held since childhood about, you know, being a global citizen. I first read that idea when I was probably 11 or 12, and I didn't know what it meant, but it resonated with me. Okay. I read it in a poem, which loosely translated to, you know, if the world accepts me as my own, who then is a stranger to my soul? Something like that, you know, meaning if the world embraces me, then who is a stranger? And I read that and I thought, there is something that speaks to me. And I was too young to fully process it. But I remember still reading that and being moved by it. And so the idea of being a world citizen and embracing the world as my home, it became a very natural idea. So I personally would look at different cultures with curiosity as just an extension. And what I learned through the process is, if you strip away the language and some of the cultural nuances and practices, ultimately, all human, you know, everybody has hopes and dreams and fears and aspirations. And learning to meet people as people was just a really fulfilling reward of having that global responsibility. The rest of the things, to the point that we made about Sapien, the fact that we had a pretty commonly shared set of beliefs and behaviors that everybody bought into, it made things fairly easy. Also, if I look at specifically in the Sapien context, you know, India had a very large technology footprint. A lot of the other geographies had a lot of the strategy and creative footprint. And just being interested in strategy and creative and the boundaries, you know, the intersections of technology and strategy and creative, it just pulled me into conversations that I was delighted to be a part of. So it was a huge, you know, growth journey as much as it was rewarding professionally. Just personally, I grew so much just by being in those rooms at those moments.
If we fast forward to, let's say, today or in the world that you've most recently been experiencing, how do you see that what you're describing, I would say, sort of the global citizen as one word, or also just embracing ourselves as human beings, regardless of where we are and how we look upon the world, but to know that deep down we're all kind of the same. How do you see that in other leaders? Because you have access to many others that are either globally or at least in responsibility of their parts of the organization. Do you see that as typical in how you're viewing yourself?
I think there are things that are common and or that are becoming more universal. And one of them is, in fact, it's related to your own mission and what you explained about SoulWorks. And it's related to, you know, life planning, and especially in midlife planning. I think globally today, as I go around the world or meet people from around the world, I think we are at a point in time where life planning has to be more deliberate, because a few things, you know, which we all know are happening, and they're happening. They're not restricted to any particular geography. It's impacting the whole world, right? So a very simple one is life expectancy. It's increasing. So if you have a higher likelihood of, let's say, living till 90, than perhaps your previous generation, I'm saying on the aggregate, right? So the template that our parents or their parents followed in terms of figuring out a career will not work for our generation. If we are going to live till 90, let's say, we can't think of a work life that ends at 65 or 70. What are you going to do for 20 years? So that's one. So financial security has gone down around the world, I think. Just retirement planning is proving to be more challenging because of shift in, you know, increased longevity, but also shift in many of the models that have so far fueled, you know, pensions and you know, the bottom of the pyramid in terms of age, you know, demographics. That's kind of getting challenged in country after country. You have new technology, which certainly in our lifetime will dramatically disrupt how we think of education and careers. You know, there's a greater sense of isolation amongst individuals, amongst leaders. So when you look at that, I think those are shared experiences across countries. And so I have seen a lot more middle-aged leaders that are exploring what it means to be a professional, how to reimagine themselves given these unique set of challenges that they have no kind of book to refer to, no person to look at and model from, that are struggling. And in the process, many of them are falling back on, like, what does it mean to be me? What's unique to me? What makes me happy? because they know the answers that we learned through our corporate roles and careers will not outlive the rest of our lives. We have to discover that. And so I see a lot more exploration of some of these aspects than ever before. A year back, I discovered writing on LinkedIn, Julia, and I stumbled on it. And today, these days, what I realized is I find the most joy in just writing about reflections from a midlife standpoint, just my challenges and things that I wish for different, not wish for different in a nostalgic way that I miss, or I'm figuring out changes that are happening in me as a result of embracing new technology and, you know, in how I think and my beliefs. And from people that read and the people that reach out, it's resonating a lot more than I expected it to be, because I think those fears and those struggles are universal now. So I think I strayed from your question, but that's a common theme that I see around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to, you know, pick up on some of the symptoms, like the life expectancy is growing, demographics are changing, technology is obviously far more front and center. But I do make the experience, and this is maybe very Germany focused, but I am making the experience that there are we in middle age, let's put it this way, are actually straying away from what you're so wonderfully saying, to reflect and to start to question ourselves. Well, you know, who am I now, or who do I want to become? I'm not seeing enough of those questions, because not maybe because the individual doesn't want to, but the stresses and the responsibilities that are because of the politics or because of the challenges on a market perspective are just too big. The time isn't provided. So I wonder, you know, maybe just through your own modeling, how you are making the time to put these questions in front of yourself and to even find the time. By the way, anyone who's intrigued, do please go look out Faraj Deep's LinkedIn posts, because they are very, very, not only beautiful, but they are very, very, they give a lot of sense for oneself. Yeah, so how do you find that time? What could you maybe give others, or how to nudge others maybe to do what you're saying, i.e., begin to question ourselves how the second half of life is going to unfold?
Yeah, so first, I may disappoint you. I don't know that I have a universal kind of prescription. I'll tell you what. There were a few things that worked for me. One was I took a break from a 17-year-long career sometime in 2018. And because I had worked in the same place for 17 years, it afforded me a chance to pause a little bit. It just gave me the need to pause a little bit and ask, what do I want to do next? Right. I wasn't prepared to jump into another corporate gig just through inertia of motion. I wanted to pause and ask. And that took me in unexpected directions. Not quite relevant for, you know, this conversation, but the point was that that was an opportunity life afforded me that I didn't quite plan for. Right. But the other thing was just the conviction that the way I had led my life and career, and more importantly, what I valued, where I got fulfillment from, that I knew and I believed very strongly was not going to see me through the next half of my life. Mm. Right. So if I look at, if you look at just, you know, how most of us have been conditioned to find fulfillment, and it's a lot of it is through professional accomplishment, right? And if we, that's just social conditioning. All right. So, you know, whether it's titles and roles and how many people I manage and compensation and I'm not saying they're not important. Okay. I'm not saying that, but the recognition that I can't sustain them the same way for the next, let's say, 40 years. And I need to create at least another parallel definition of fulfillment that, you know, I can tap into that will make me feel as good about me and my life when I don't have my title and my roles and, you know, all of these to fall back on. That was very, very clear to me. And that became a little bit more of a creative pursuit and just trying to understand what gave me joy. And I rediscovered, let's say, photography and writing, and through writing, trying to find my own voice. Now, I'm not good enough to make a living off them, but I discovered that they gave me fulfillment in a way that my professional career didn't exactly in the same way. And so I restructured my life to allow them to coexist where I could pursue both, which wasn't the case for me before, where I was so single-mindedly focused on pursuing my career aspirations and doing whatever it took to stay in the game, air quotes, you know. And that, this conviction, followed by this little bit of exploration, that opened up this, kind of moving away from a straitjacketed kind of, you know, role and path to having other definitions of who I am and what it means to be me and what gives me joy. Also, the third thing that I did, and that is, I don't want to say like, make it sound like, I started to play with a lot of new technologies, basically, and make it a part of my life. And it again came from the conviction that I have to learn to coexist with these technologies for the next 30, 40 years. So not learning them, I can defer that for a little while, but I cannot avoid it because they're just going to take over our lives, right? And we can choose the role these technologies play in our lives, but we cannot choose to completely, unless we want to live off the grid and, I wasn't willing to sign up for that. So it's just, incorporating all of that. And through that process, reducing a little of the fear that is natural for a lot of us to find ourselves in, I remember speaking with a friend and a mentor 4 or 5 years back, and this is around the time when I had left my previous career, a long career, and I was exploring, and I asked him, how should I think about the next 5 years? And he gave me such a beautiful way to think about it. He said, look, if you're planning to work for another 5 years, then there's one answer. If you're planning to work for another 20 years, then there is a different answer, right? And I thought that was really clarifying, because if you want to remain in some professional capacity, if you want to remain productive, then you have to reinvent yourself. You can't sustain what brought you here and take that set of learning and knowledge and expect to see the next 20 years through it. It just became very obvious. Whereas if it were just, if I wanted to work for the next 5 years and then retire forever, then I could, drag my whatever life had taught me. I could use that and pick up a few more jobs, but that's not what I wanted. So that also created a natural kind of impetus to pursue learning and figure out how, just how to be productive and how to create value without kind of relying on organizations and titles and hierarchies and people. Of course, you need other people, but not relying on that, you know, just things that you can produce yourselves that are part of you. So that was very helpful advice, and that really helped me kind of see my life clearly and make choices. But these are all journeys. I'm perhaps making it sound like it's all done.
Exactly. Check. It's all figured. I mean, just coming back to the first, having a pause. I would love that we even install that in our work time in life, that we say, okay, come midlife, you have to take a half year out or a year out and just allow yourself to renew or to reinvent, as you said, yourself. And there is a natural, there is just a natural tendency, even through neuroscience, that we go from this, trying to think of the English words now, but from a fluid mind to a crystalline mind, and that already changes the way that we perceive. So there is a natural chemical course in our bodies that's already triggering, pause, rethink, reinvent what's now really necessary, or what's pulling you, what's drawing you. But coming to the technology piece, or wanting to stay in a way in that game. And where you said, 20 years, that prompt, to use that word, that prompt changed your perception. My question is, can you outline what, for you at least, these 20 years mean? You know, what does being productive, being in work, what does that actually mean for you?
So I have just started up, my wife and I, and I did a startup exactly 27 years back. So late 90s, I did my first startup, failed spectacularly. but I was thinking about what drove me then and what drives me now. And back then, you know, the risk-taking, there was an excitement in jumping into the unknown, risk-taking and just proving myself. And there was a thrill, and I was pursuing thrill, you know. Of course, you know, there was ambition and there's impact and all of that. But ultimately, I was backing myself. I wanted to see what I could do. So there was a little bit more, or a lot of me in that ambition, you know. When I think of what we are doing today, in a nutshell, we are creating a platform that will help families manage, and particularly families in India, manage their health information and health data. And it comes from the lived experience. Both my wife and I have been caregivers, family caregivers for 20 plus years, that, you know, we have a lot of medical records that are stuck as paper documents in files and folders in family cupboards. They're not in the organized system. So that's the problem we wanted to solve. And when I look at that problem versus the problem that I wanted to tackle 27 years back, whether we succeed or not, there's a high likelihood we'll fail, like all startups, or most startups do. But I can say that this is us, because it reflects our, not just our learning, but it's a problem that we uniquely identify with, that we think we see that very clearly, and we think a problem shouldn't exist, that friction shouldn't exist for people. And we want to bring whatever meager talents we have in the service of that. I think there is a shift in just, from way back when to now, in what drives me, what drives many people like me, friends and colleagues that I speak to, I'll speak about myself, is just being true to myself in both the selection of my focus and what warrants my attention. And you know, look, lofty words like mission and impact, and they mean something. I don't want to dismiss them. But ultimately, that is it authentic? Is it uniquely me? And has my life brought me here to kind of find this problem? I think that exploration is really powerful. It unlocks meaning and energy in ways that just intellectual processing of a opportunity doesn't. So what do the next 20 years look like? Certainly curiosity, exploration, and as I was telling you earlier, perhaps at the beginning of this conversation, I like to stay in the overlapping areas across disciplines. So in the process, learn new disciplines and then figure out what's interesting in what I know and this new perspective or new discipline that somebody else is willing to teach me, and then explore what problems exist there and what can be done. So certainly see that. I hope that continues to be part of my future. And I feel the creative expression, you know, it's become really important to me. And you know, I told you I write, and I write not because I have an audience. I don't. Okay, most people don't. I had to give up my seeking any validation or my fear of rejection in order to write. Like every week, I show up on LinkedIn every week and I write whatever's on my mind. But that gives me space to think clearly, to understand. Writing is thinking, you know. So when I write, I clarify my own thoughts. I understand where I stand on a particular issue, how strongly I feel about something, and so I write to explore that part of me, you know. And it may not resonate with anyone else. Funnily, both my startup founder thing and my LinkedIn writer role, both of those taught me something an overlapping idea, which is, you know, you can't get both reach and richness. What I mean by that is when I write what is uniquely my perspective, very few people read it because it doesn't resonate with a lot of people. And if I modify my writing to appeal to a lot of people, then it's no longer mine. You know, it's manufactured, it's artificial. Similarly, as I'm designing my product, I have a choice between what will uniquely solve the problem of few people brilliantly or meet the problem of a lot of people somewhat okay. So, you know, it will be liked but not really loved. And so in both of those roles, coming to terms with those choice and knowing where you are willing to be misunderstood and by who and by how much, you know, that's what it's teaching me. And I really, really love it. I love to be, you know, to be put on the spot and really ask what matters to me. And whether I like to accept it in front of the world or not, in my own heart, I know the answer to that, you know, what matters to me. And exploring that and wrestling with that, that's something that both of those, my current pursuits are exposing me to. And I really, I'm enjoying that.
Yeah, beautiful. And it sort of brings up in me, maybe, and there's going to be a bit of hypothetical stuff now coming out of my mouth that would be interesting to hear your view on this. But how it's coming to me when you're speaking is, you know, remaining true to yourself and remaining in this richness than in the reach, if we just go by LinkedIn. but also in your startup or in what you're creating there is you really fundamentally wish to be of service with what you are doing. And it's dear to you. It matters to you. And whether it reaches, you know, the world or whether it first of all just makes its reach within your own vicinity, it will find itself. And I really do believe that when we in a way operate from that very heartfelt place, it will find its way. Potentially not only in your own lifetime, but maybe it will find legs beyond your own lifetime. And it poses the question, this is where the hypothetical piece comes in. I'm hearing from many leaders in the corporate world who have either stepped out or are in the process of stepping out that they recognize, you said, fear of rejection. Oh dear, am I going to be relevant anymore? Is anyone going to like me anymore? I think that's a tendency I keep hearing that we have to walk through and go through. But the hypothesis is, does that mean that the corporate world, or to take on roles where we have reach, at some point in our lives, we then step out to then become more truer to ourselves, and we leave these roles for people who are still on this journey of proving and thrill, as how you said it earlier. Or you know, who's going to lead these big organizations, and what do we need to shift so that we can actually feel that there is also service in these big corporations, and it's not just a transactional relationship in these organizations.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know whether you got my drift there, but I'm like,
yeah. No, I certainly did. Look, if you want to create impact at scale, large organizations still remain the primary vehicle to do that, right? Mm-hmm. So the good thing is the world is diverse enough and large enough to accommodate all kinds of, you know, drivers, all kinds of people. I think I know many friends who lead tremendously fulfilling, successful careers where they have been able to balance the needs of a big global corporate career with, their personal needs vis-a-vis family and creative fulfillment and health and whatnot. So I certainly don't presume that the only way to get fulfillment is to, jump off the corporate treadmill. I think depending on what you're seeking, what talents you have, the corporation that you're a part of, that is absolutely an extremely it's a very noble way of creating impact, right? I've done that for 20 plus years. So the only thing that I would say based on my own experience is, if I look back on my corporate career, it took me a long time to assimilate what gave me joy with what my work demanded of me. And if I could do it all over again, I would bring it together a lot sooner, right? So I think I might have been happier. I was very happy. I was delighted, in my corporate career. And I formally left a corporate job in late 2024. Bringing the whole of me and in seeing the whole of me and creating space for the whole of me, that I didn't do till very late, and that I think in hindsight, that's if I could, based just on my personal experience, if there's one thing I could share with others, it would be that there is value in that, in seeing and the entirety of you and what gives you joy. Because if ever you step off that corporate treadmill, it's the other pieces that will sustain you. So you need to fuel that. You need to recognize that. You need to give that space. And your heart will tell you, right, when you're feeding that and when you're not. And listening to that, I've found is really important.
And how could we do that? Just going by your own experience and through what you're now sort of referencing and suggesting, bringing the whole of us also in the working world together, how could we facilitate that? Again, we being the larger we, not just you and I in our own areas, but how could we do that? Because I do think that that's one of the keys.
Yeah, Julia, the good thing is I'm seeing a lot more people today that are both aware of what gives them joy and are making those choices. And in a way, as much as, you know, AI is taking away jobs in some places, it's also enabling the pursuit of these other careers because the learning curve has been shortened and you have like a helper who can help you. Research is free, a lot of those. So I'm seeing a lot more people that are, almost supporting a second career that's more in the direction of their creative fulfillment or maybe partnering with a spouse or a friend and doing that. So how can we do that? I don't want to be too abstract, but my friends that are still struggling to embrace this idea despite feeling the need, I think for a lot of them, it's been a lack of clarity around what gives them that fulfillment. And to your point, there has been no scope to explore other pursuits outside of the workplace, which is why when you said there should almost be a mandatory kind of, you know, sabbatical in middle age, I thought it's such a brilliant idea. It would bring up our collective, you know, productivity in organizations and in countries because you'd allow people to just discover the balance that many people, especially as they approach middle ages, they feel lacking a little bit. So I didn't get a chance to say it then. I thought it was a brilliant idea and the corporations should embrace it, you know, and not to make it an ageist thing, but anybody should take. But, you know, having sabbatical as a way to recharge or refresh, but also rethink your priorities, because it does really get very hard to do when you're in the throes of your daily work and your priorities and your meeting schedule and, you know, all of that routine. I think taking some time off in however it works for different people, exploring different pursuits is not just helpful, but I think it's increasingly necessary, you know. Everybody says we are moving into, it's a lot of analysts will say we're moving into this creator economy, right? The people that create, they get to monetize their creation. And that's the direction a lot of people are exploring. And again, the same AI technologies are being incredibly helpful if you want to pursue those kind of areas. And I think, you know, time going back to my life planning idea, this figuring out secondary income streams, you know, outside of work, that also will become increasingly important, right? So understanding one's talents, understanding my interests, understanding what I want to feed and directions I want to grow. And look, you know, if I can't monetize and I can't make money, at least I'll be happy. I am a big fan of that exploration and midlife. I think it enriches even if you choose to remain in the same place. That exploration just enriches your perspective, your worldview. So
yeah. And I think it, if I were to bring this conversation to one thing, then it is the exploration of oneself. And you, many a times were referencing the curiosity, which you're keeping in front of you, but then also the curiosity within and how exploring our own self, recognizing maybe the fears, recognizing the opportunities that we can embrace, recognize that we have many more years to live, technically at least, than our previous generations. And there's so much to still unfold and to walk that path, and maybe to know that we can do this in a different way than how we've spent, in quotation marks, the first half of our life, which is all good how it was. We can now just shift again. So yeah, that I think that's where we can then also help generate so much more potential that we have, where sometimes at a societal level we're dismantling that potential. Sometimes the bias is we don't believe that, the older we get, we still have a lot of potential within us. Let's not jump into that bias and prove differently.
That's beautiful. That's well said.
Yeah. I'm intrigued. I could continue on, and I'm looking now down at my notes because there is one question that I like to leave with, even though I feel the conversation hasn't quite finished. But let's see if this question opens up, because I always ask my guests to leave one question for my next guest. And the question that I have here is, how do you believe relationships shift in the second half of life? What happens? So that's the question I have for you. How do you believe relationships shift in the second half of our life? What have you noticed?
So the first thing that I notice in my relationships are, so if I look at friends and family a little differently, I think in the second half of our lives, of my life, I seek out friends that who I can connect through more through shared values and less through, shared accomplishments, if that makes any sense. Whereas a lot of my choices of friends were just based on circumstances that put us together in, there was a little bit of a healthy competition around, what one is doing, accomplishing. And they have become totally meaningless and irrelevant. And I seek out friends that, enrich my perspective, that are bringing that have had a different life experience, but that have the same shared values. So that's what I notice in friendships, and I'm very, very intentional about that in the kind of friends that I like to spend time with. Of course, I'll go anywhere, but I'm also an introvert. So after a while, I need to go back to my own place and kind of get back my energy. And so my energy is best spent with people that, that have the same value score, if you may. So I make those choices. As it relates to more kind of family relationships, partner and others, I think for me, the recognition that I'm not the person I was 20 years back, nor is the other person the same that I knew 20 years back, and this constant recalibration, just as I spoke about exploration and wanting to, discover life. The other people in my life are on the same journey, right? And sometimes it may converge and many times it may not converge. And you know, holding that space for them to explore their, you know, whatever makes sense for them, and recognizing that it may not be the same as before. That's been both behaviorally challenging, but otherwise liberating, you know, just recognizing the shift in relationships based on, I wouldn't say values, but, you know, choices, people, explorations, just adventures people want to be in. So that's been, I've had to just accept that I have no choice, but also recognizing we are all on our own journeys and they can coexist. That was a tough question, but that's where my mind went when I thought of that question.
Thank you. Thank you also for sharing. At least this is how it's. I'm receiving it, and probably because I can also recognize myself in this. For those that are dearest to us, to accept that we're all on our own journeys, and even though we're walking side by side, the exploration, the adventure can be different for each one of us, and that's not always easy to accept. But it is beautiful when we can accept.
Yeah. It's letting everyone be whoever they were meant to be.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. I'm wondering whether you have a question that you would love to pose the next guest when it relates to midlife or to the middle-aged, or just to the midlife journey.
I can't say, Julia, I have any well-formed questions, okay? There are so many places my mind's going, but if it's okay, I'm just going to...
Absolutely, yeah. Stay with it. No, perfect. Absolutely. I want to say thank you for this conversation, Rajdeep, for all your sharing, for everything that you've provided. There is so much, and we only landed at the end around exploration and staying true to oneself and curiosity, but there's so much more in this conversation. And I really thank you for your time and for your sharing. It was great. And a huge pleasure to see you again.
Pleasure was all mine, Juliet. I have been looking forward to it, and despite standing you up once in one of the earlier, you have to know that this meant a lot. Just your way of asking questions and building on the answers, there's a lot that I took away in your synthesis, connecting it back to other perspectives. So I really appreciate that. And it's been such a pleasure. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you. After this conversation with Rajdeep, I find myself sitting with a quiet sense of appreciation and reflection. There was something deeply grounding about the way he spoke. The way Rajdeep spoke of leadership, not as a race to the top, but as a continuous act of responsibility and reinvention. And what stayed with me most is how rooted Rajdeep was, rooted in his values, his humanity, and his willingness to evolve even after decades of success. It reminded me that midlife isn't a crisis to fix. It's a passage to walk through consciously. It's that moment when the question shifts from what am I achieving to who am I becoming? And that question, I believe, goes beyond the personal. It's also the question for leadership and for the companies we build, because we are living in a time of thresholds where the systems and structures that once held us are breaking apart. The world has become what is now claimed as Barney, brittle, anxious, nonlinear, incomprehensible. We've moved past the VUCA and now we're in the Barney. And it's not just the outer world that feels unstable. Many leaders today carry that same turbulence inside. And in such times, leadership asks for something different, not only sharper minds, but softer hearts, not only strategy, but stillness. And when the outer world becomes chaotic, we need to anchor within in our principles, our presence, and our ability to truly connect. And maybe that's what Rajdeep pointed to without naming it, the courage to lead as a whole human being with empathy, imagination, and grace. To let reinvention be not a reaction to crisis, but a natural rhythm of renewal. Perhaps that's the real work ahead for all of us, is to weave or reweave relationship and reflection into the fabric of work, to bring more listening, more humanity, even a bit more poetry maybe, into how we lead, because renewal always begins with relationship. So here's my reflection, my invitation. What would it change if organizations became places not just of performance, but of presence? If we treated reinvention not as an exception, but as part of how life moves through us individually and collectively? That's my hope from this conversation. And I hope it gives you, wherever you are in your journey, permission to pause, to unmask a little, to breathe, and to ask what's next, not out of fear, but out of love. Thank you for listening and for walking this path with me. If this episode spoke to you, I'd love to hear from you. Leave a note, send me an email, or rate the podcast. It means a lot, and it helps these reflections find others who might need them too. Thank you. Until next time, keep listening, keep leading, and keep living in full expression.